everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Shattered Live's second birthday party show. So everything is going to be a little different. Everything is going to be a lot of fun. But we've got some fantastic guests, and your phone lines are open tonight. Usually they're not. So tonight is the night. If you have questions, if you want to call in with comments for Donna Gore, who has been the very, very faithful host of this show for the last 2 years, every Saturday she's been here. For the first hour, we have Will Marling, who is executive director of NOVA, the National Organization for Victims Assistance. The second hour, we have scheduled Tim Palmbach from Henry Lee Institute. So let's get on with the show, and I want to bring Donna on right now to say hello and happy birthday, Shattered Lives.
Hi, Delilah. Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to do this because I think this is a benchmark. It's a time for celebration and enjoyment. And I just want to say, and I know you like to be behind the scenes person, but I thank you so much for all of your effort and your and everything you've done. I couldn't have done this for 2 years without you. So it's as they say in the Academy Awards, this is a shared night. So I share it with you.
Well, thank you so much. I know you know how to push the button. So don't sell yourself short here.
Okay. That's true. Well, speaking of pushing the buttons, that's what you're going to be doing in terms of the switchboard and bringing mm-hmm. people on. And we hope that we have a lot of people with some intriguing questions for Will, because that's part of the reason why he's here this evening. And it's just so nice to have somebody else kind of carry the load, you know, and I can kind of sit back in my glory and relax a little bit and have fun with people. So, Will, we are so pleased to have you here. And, you know, it might be just to let people know if they can call in to ask a crime-related question, or if you happen to listen to a health and wellness show, or we've done a couple of GBLT shows, or we've done some things on disability, but primarily crime. They can also call in just to say congratulations. We'll take that. They can also call in to tell us what their affiliation with the show has been, what their topic was, and I would love to be able to promote you again and give your contact information and brag about what a good guest you were. So you've got all of those choices, my audience. So it's your time to shine as well, okay? So I don't know, Delilah, do we have somebody from the switchboard that we want to bring on now, or should we have Will say a few words first?
Well, we don't have a caller yet, so I think, you know, let's have a conversation and bring on Will Marling.
Okay, Will, welcome.
Well, thank you, ladies. What a privilege to be here. I can't imagine all the people that you've interviewed, and you asked me to be part of this incredibly special occasion, and you know that it's just so very touching that you would, first of all, consider me a subject matter expert that you would have on your show for an extended period of time to take calls. I mean, that's a pretty trusting thing to let your callers talk to me. I mean, you know, I don't know. I just think it's pretty brave. But I also want to extend, of course, my sincerest congratulations for 2 years and the important work that you're doing, because I would say, having, you know, worked with you, Donna, and now Delilah, the amazing things, it's kind of shattered lives, reconstructing lives, because of the incredibly positive work that you're doing. So kudos to you, and thank you for having me. I'm ready to go at it.
Well, great. It's our pleasure to have you. And might I say, you know, our introduction was formally last September at the NOVA conference. Although I was back in the days of Marlene and John Young, and I'm dating myself there too, because our homicide happened in 1981, and it has been there what 39 or 40 years, Will?
That's right. 1975 was when NOVA incorporated, and of course, yeah, there was movement around the movement prior to that, 1975, but officially we started in 75.
Mm-hmm. And just so that callers know that will be lining up, if they had not had the opportunity to listen to our stellar show that we did 2 months ago, can you just give people a little thumbnail sketch in terms of the areas that you consider you have the most expertise in, some of the things that we talked about on the show so that they know how to formulate a question around those areas perhaps?
Sure. Well, let me give you just a brief summary of NOVA, and then we can talk about maybe some topics that might be of interest for folks tonight. NOVA is the oldest victim assistance organization of its kind in the nation, and as I like to say, my European colleagues who I've been working with now at Victim Support Europe, and then my Asian colleagues who are doing this work, they would testify that NOVA probably is the oldest of its kind in the world. And, you know, that comes with its own duties and responsibilities. You can be the oldest and have lost touch with that, but one of the reasons I'm so proud to be part of this amazing network is that innovation and contemporary commitment is part of that deep, long history that NOVA has demonstrated. So our mission is to champion dignity and compassion for those who are harmed by crime and crisis, and, of course, that involves the wide and sad range of the ways people can harm each other criminally, but we know that many times crimes aren't even reported for a lot of reasons, and so we still want to support people in addressing injustice or addressing their harm. We also have a side of the house where we deal with disasters and disaster work and training people who would go into disasters and dealing with people who are traumatized. So that's kind of the NOVA picture. We do a lot of training. We have a toll-free victim assistance number. Of course, we deal with policy issues. We're based in the Washington, D.C. area. My particular area of expertise, of course, is leadership, leading the organization, of which I'm so honored and proud to have this position. And quite honestly, I sometimes think there are so many more people who are fully capable and beyond my capacities in leading, but nonetheless, I'm here. And my focus is specifically, I have an area of focus in terms of the cyber victim assistance, and so I've trained up in that, and I focus on the victim assistance portion of that, but also training and education for prevention in the cyber, the identity theft, data breach, and that like. But, of course, I have to be, in some ways, jack of all trades and then master of that one in leading an organization that has a victim assistance line, and so our staff responds to those victim assistance calls every day nationwide. And, you know, I try to do my very best to contribute to that. It's a small percentage of the kinds of calls we get, but I do answer those calls, particularly when they fall in my areas. Stalking is an area that I address as well as the cyber, because they can work together. It's one of the things about crime. You know, most criminals don't think, well, gee, I'm going to be just a stalker. They think I'm going to hurt somebody.
Yeah, they escalate, don't they?
Yeah, and they think about it. They just think about hurting people however they want to do it. So, you know, domestic violence can become a stalking issue, that can become an identity theft issue, that can be a, you know, other abuse issues and this kind of thing. So, nonetheless, you know, as a person leading and engaged in the needs that people face in this particular arena, I'm certainly honored to be able to talk with folks who want to talk, and if I don't have anything to contribute to their needs, I'll tell them outright, but otherwise there might be some things to discuss.
Right. Will, are you able to, if the location for the next NOVA conference, is it still under negotiation?
No, we just released that information. We're pleased to...
Oh, you did?
Can you
divulge?
Absolutely. It's on our website, so I better be able to, or I'm going to be in trouble. It's going to be August 17 to 20, 2014, of course, and that's going to be in Chicago at the Palmer House Hilton, an exceptional hotel.
Oh, great.
And,
Chicago's
a great city.
Okay, say that one more time for me. Okay, August what?
August 17 to 20.
Yep. Okay, at the Palmer House.
At the Palmer House Hilton, and that's it's right downtown.
Wonderful. Oh, my goodness. And so in that process, you're lining up keynotes and speakers and all of that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, we actually will have between 100 and 110 workshops over the course of 4 days. And, you know, today there is a lot of good training out there, and we're pleased to be part of that cadre of trainers, the instructors that we bring together for those days. But it's a lot of varied options, as you can imagine. There's themes to those, you know, in terms of victimization specialties, domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, the like. I mean, it's, you know, you kind of get depressed just thinking about the list. But at the same time, you know, the folks who are in this work are very committed to it. And so we address that as well as leadership issues in organizations, a lot of different dimensions to that training. And so it's pretty hardcore. I'm telling you, what has always amazed me is you think about advocates coming from around the country. We'll also have advocates from other parts of the world. They like to come. And many of them will start in first class, first day. They'll go all the way through 4 days to the end. And, you know, they're absolutely relentless, tireless when it comes to training. They want to do it. So we make it full on. Four full days, and then we don't work in the at night. That's time to see the city, have social time, network with folks. You know, you got to have a break from the intensity of the training. And of course, Chicago's a great city. We're right in the heart of people can walk out the Palmer House and just enjoy the city at night.
That's exciting. We do have a caller. We have a caller.
Wonderful.
Derek. Yeah. Say hello to Derek from Ryan United.
Hey,
hi, Derek.
You're on
the
air, Derek.
Well, congratulations to Donna and Delilah for 2 years. I thought I'd call in and congratulate you, and thanks for coming
on,
Will.
You.
And I've been listening, and I appreciate everything you do on behalf of NOVA. And
you're cool.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on.
Nice. Thank you.
Yeah.
I make new friends every day.
Yeah.
Thank you, Donna.
What's that?
Appreciate you, Derek.
You know, it's a pleasure. Derek, maybe you can give a thumbnail sketch with regard to our other listeners if people are not familiar with your organization. We're very proud to have had you on there. And, in fact, I'm going to snag you very soon regarding my victim impact writing service because I know you were interested. So thank you for coming on first. That was like a good omen for me, man.
Yeah. Well, Ryan United is we're a nonprofit. We're based in Montana, actually, but we travel all over the country. My brother Ryan was 8 years old when he was abducted from our backyard in a little Montana town here, and he was murdered by a repeat sex offender. The guy that kidnapped Ryan and murdered him was just out of prison not even 90 days for a similar crime against a child about 3 years prior to Ryan's murder. So we have legislated not only in our state but in several other states on sex offender management laws and sensible laws that work, you know, to manage offenders properly. And then we do quite a bit in the realm of victim advocacy and try and support victims who've, you know, faced either what we are facing or face some kind of crime. So we work every day to make sure that victims are taken care of, and that's why I appreciate what you guys do and what Will's doing. And I think the more folks we have in this circle, the stronger we'll get.
Well, I definitely
Derek,
agree with that. And I don't know, Will, if you've had the opportunity to know Derek before his organization, but, you know, Derek is an excellent presenter, too. Perhaps you should take your paper and pen, Will, and take all these notes so that we can fill up your whole conference.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I love what he's saying. I'll just tell you, Derek, we have a RFP, a request for proposal. So I'll get your contact information. I'll send you the RFP if you want to give it a shot. You certainly, you know, bring. Can I ask a question, Donna? It sounds weird because
I'm supposed
to be, you know, doing this. But, I work kind of transparently. I think we need to just confront issues and talk about them. in a, as a reasonable, sensible way, not react to anything in particular, but literally discuss out the issues. And I know, Derek, there's a I've seen a pretty meaningful reaction to, like, sex offender registries,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, that they're devastating and destructive to people. And my question is, just from your perspective in the work, give me your perspective on effectiveness there, if you would or want to. Again, I'm not trying to open up worms from cans or anything. I'm just intrigued by what you're doing, and of course I'm so sorry that you lost your brother that moved you to this path.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of different things that go along the lines of sex offender management, and especially the registry. The first one being, how accurate is the registry? You have these offenders that are on there. How accurate is the information on there? Because what we've essentially done is put these registries out there and said, okay, Joe Public, you want to find out who's in your area, go and check this site. Well, we've come to find out that several states don't have accurate information on there, which leads to a false sense of security for the public. That's
right.
one problem with the registry. Secondly, what the misconception is with the public, when you say sex offender to somebody walking down the street, their first reaction is what? The worst of the worst, the guy that killed my brother. That's what comes to mind with most folks. Well, really what we do with Ryan United and our organization is trying to educate people on what sex offenders are and what they aren't, and really how to keep vigilant against the ones that are the worst of the worst, because there are some out there. And then we further go to define what the registry is and the different types of offenders that exist on our registry. And not the vast majority of sex offenders want to do what they're told to do, and we know that statistically. So really there's, dispelling those myths. I think the sex offender registry is good. I think we need to have it. I think that it's from firsthand experience in our work with the U.S. Marshals, we've gotten information off the registry that's inaccurate, and as a result, it's led to an arrest and possibly saved another victim. So I think there's some very good attributes to the registry, but yeah, we need to work on it, and we need to do that together as a country and not state by state. I hope I answered your question there. So.
That's great.
Those are real professional
insights.
While Derek is still on the line, we've got I think it's a very important question from the chat room, from Amy Sanagata. She writes that in her county, a girl was molested by her next-door neighbor when she was 7, and now she's being re-traumatized because he finished his sentence. He was allowed to move back into his former home, and now the girl is she's 19 years old, but there's no law that keeps him from moving back next door to her.
Right. That's my
question.
How
do you address that?
Yeah. Well, and that goes back to the failure of the, whoever is supervising that individual. When they put these people back out in the community, what's the best scenario? I just had a case the other day where a guy that molested 9 boys in one area in one town was put back right back in the house he lived in before. Is that a good decision? It's probably not. But we're looking at issues like housing for offenders that come out. And that's really leads to a question that I had for Will is, what are we dealing, or is NOVA looking at anything as far as reentry of offenders for victims? And we're not just talking sex offenders, any kind of offender that comes back into a community. What are the resources for victims who maybe faced a crime 15 years ago that all of a sudden they're faced with this offender right back in their community and maybe sometimes back into their family? Are those areas being looked at?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll tell you what we're doing at the kind of a higher level. And by higher, I don't mean, that it's ethereal, but it's as much trying to connect dots. So there are folks who are very committed to reentry and reentry for offenders in a sensible way. In other words, they care about victims, but they're trying to address the reentry issues because we all know that recidivism or having repeat offense can be enhanced if somebody coming out of incarceration, doesn't have tools, place to go, these kinds of things. So, you know, what we're trying to do, first of all, is make sure that a voice for victims is speaking into those particular groups, if they're willing to hear it. Many of them are.
Right.
We're also discovering that a lot of the energies are not focused around the victims, not because people don't care about the victims, they just aren't aware. Just like you're highlighting, the gap is that the system has long since been done with their responsibility for victims, right? Because there's pretrial, and even in incarceration, there's many times advocates in the prison system. They're responsible to communicate different things to the victims and so on. But, you know, once that person is considered paroled, let's say, or has served time, and so that's not even paroled, that's done, then basically it's, you're out there and you're on your own, and the victims are the same.
Right.
So it is a real issue in terms of thinking about, as we would call it, predict and prepare for the victims. And what if there aren't a lot of official formal resources, how can we then educate them to think about what are your needs and how can you, in a sense, build up a reserve emotionally, financially, physically,
right,
to prepare? So it's a great question.
We have to do a lot of talking, Will, because I've done some research on it, and really I've come up with a couple of different plans, and I come up with plans all the time. I'm writing stuff down during the night as I wake up, you know. But, you know, just to give you an example, the guy that killed my brother was moved out of the state of Montana prison after he was sentenced. He was moved. He's been all over the United States as a result of our prison riots that happened here in 1992. He was moved out of Montana and allowed to go to these other different prisons. Well, we just found out 2 weeks ago, and this is, my brother was killed in 87. We just found out 2 weeks ago that the Department of Corrections had moved him back to the state of Montana, where my entire family lives.
Wow.
And they called me and said, oh, by the way, we've moved this guy back, and he's now in your state. You know, he's now in our state prison. Well, even though he's behind bars, the impact that that had on my family was unbelievable. And I'm the spokesperson for my family, so I go to all of them, and I say, this guy's back in the state. And really to see the impact all those years later really got to me thinking, what are the gaps there, and how are we helping to prepare victims, even if it was 15 years down the road? What are we doing to help them, you know?
Right. So is that an area, Will, that we collectively need, not only NOVA, but we collectively need to think about, you know, out-of-the-box kind of ideas to address these gaps, such as what Amy was saying, you know, 15 years later now, and the person can move back in with absolutely no repercussions or accountability?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would suggest that it's one reason why we need to collaborate, and folks are kind of specialists like Derek.
Yeah.
You know, he has a bigger view of the issue for sure, which is awesome. And I come into this kind of with that realizing, looking the landscape and saying, you know, we need to think about this from kind of beginning all the way through. Let me give you another example of a gap just to illustrate. You have what's called the Innocence Project, and you might have heard of the Innocence Project. Their commitment is to make sure DNA is examined, so that, you know, folks who have been convicted without DNA and inappropriately can be exonerated, and they have had meaningful success in that. Now, here's a gap. What happens if you're the victim of, you know, you're a survivor of a homicide, and DNA exonerates the person you thought had committed that crime? Well, there's no pickup and go back to victim services and say, oh, by the way, you know, let's do this again. That person is left not just standing there without assistance, but now thinking, well, who did do it?
If
you know, they might believe that they actually are releasing the wrong person, but many times people say, okay, well, we'll follow the DNA trail. And so there are many gaps like that in this system where it doesn't dawn on a lot of people, or if it does, they have no mechanism officially to respond. And we need to think through those issues.
Boy, that is, well, that's huge. Yeah.
Well, don't you think also that, you know, even just hearing what Derek had to say, there's an awful lack of communication between the Department of Corrections and the victim's family. I know that there's a lot of different alert systems available, but it seems like there's always a glitch that somehow or another these victims' families are not learning about the situation, you know, with the person who's incarcerated fast enough to think about it and deal with it.
Right.
Yeah, well, I'm certain Derek could speak more directly to this, and I certainly won't go too far with my comments because, you know, he's experiencing the system firsthand. What I would say is there is a commitment by many to try to enhance and improve that. I would say there is a certain sense of reality that comes in to the machinery, the mechanisms that revolve around this. You know, I'm tempted to say, well, actually, it's amazing that Derek's and his family got notified after all these years. But, you know, that sounds a little too, you know, a little too accommodating maybe for things that need to be improved. But certainly things have improved in many ways, and it's important for safety. It's important for physical safety at times, emotional safety, and so on. So, Derek, you speak to that because actually you're my expert here.
Well, and I agree. I think there are some things in the system that kind of sometimes with corrections and all they have to deal with, they're offender-centered. I mean, that's their deal. That's their business is to be
– true.
Sometimes they leave the victim out, but I have seen vast improvements over – you know, the time that I've been involved with Ryan United, and even back when I was in law enforcement for 18 years, you know, I left in 2008 to do Ryan United full time, and I've seen a huge improvement since then. And it also helped that we got notified. I mean, the Director of Corrections is my former boss with the Division of Criminal Investigation, so I think that helped me. But it also opened my eyes to, yeah, we need to create what are some best practices. What can we do to kind of create a go-by for Department of Corrections to say, hey, listen, you know, this person is due to come out. What are we going to do to help the family in this case, even though it's been 15 years? You know, what can we do? Oh, you know, let's grab onto this guide that NOVA has been involved with, Ryan United's been involved with, maybe the Bureau of Prisons helps us out, and we come up with that best practices to get things in place for those victims when that does occur.
I think
totally
you hit the nail
you.
On the head. I
yes.
think you hit the nail on the head, Derek, when you said that the system is very criminal-oriented in their way of thinking. And what do we have in place for the victims of these criminals and their rights, other than, you know, organizations like NOVA and several other organizations across the country? There isn't really something governmentally centralized that protects those rights and that gives them the information on a timely basis that they need.
Right.
And, you know, I just wanted to mention that, Will, I know that you worked, I think, this weekend with Michelle Cruz, and we were very lucky in having her to be our legal representative at the Board of Pardons and Paroles for the multiple murderer that killed my father. And had we not had her there, there were, you know, there were so many issues that needed to be addressed that were just not.
Right.
And so what Delilah had just said, that it's very offender-oriented, is so true. And even though, you know, your rights are supposedly written down in the parole officers and the victim advocates are supposed to follow them constitutionally in the particular states that you live in, and the judges are supposed to give their due in terms of impact, it just, more often than not, it just does not happen. And so that's why, you know, what Derek was saying, there are so many gaps here. And I'm so grateful that, Derek, you've taken the opportunity to come and to give us this commentary as well as that congratulations. I so love this, and I hope that you and Will can connect too, because I think you could probably help each other. This is great.
Yeah, I look forward to connecting with Will, and also just to let you know, if your gal that blogged in or that typed in on the on the chat room there. If she wants to get a hold of us at RyanUnited.org, we can take a look at, you know, the offender and the case and figure out.
Oh, okay, Amy?
And figure out why this guy is in the area and what his conditions are, and we can get that information back to her, you know, if you'll put her in touch with Ryan United, and we'll look at all that for her. So.
Oh, that'd be great. Wow. Thank you, Verica. I owe you a big one.
Yeah. Well, great to talk to you guys, and I want to bow out here, but happy birthday, and thank you very much, Will, for all you do. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Derek.
Wonderful. All right.
Yeah.
Take care.
God bless you, man.
All right. Cool.
Bye-bye.
Cool. Very
and Donna,
good.
Donna,
yes.
Can I would also add that a key feature that I think we discussed maybe even in our last time was the idea of a crime victims' rights amendment in the United States Constitution.
Definitely.
That could begin to affirm the needs that victims of crime should have, so that this becomes a common discussion at every level of the justice system, not kind of an afterthought. Do we need to look after the needs of offenders? Of course we do. We're talking about human beings. But we also can't ignore the impact on other people, particularly those people that were harmed by the offenders. And so human dignity is important to address when people have lost their liberty over crime committed. But, you know, the dignity must transfer over to those victims who many times are left holding, you know, the shattered pieces. And so the Victims' Rights Amendment, in our view, could be an opportunity to affirm the constitutional commitment that we have to the needs that victims of crime face, and as well promote a national discussion about these very issues from the very beginning all the way through the process.
I totally agree with you. And so, you know, not only do we get at it from a national level, but also, you know, 33 of the 50 states, you know, have their own constitutional amendment. What will it take to have the other states be on board with this? I don't know. But we shall see. Delilah, is there some other activity at this particular juncture? I know I see some people online, but is there anybody on the line, per se, yet?
No.
I'll tell
nope.
you when there
okay.
is, though.
Okay. Okay.
I promise I will bring them in.
okay.
But I think going back to what the conversation was earlier and what Will just brought up is, you know, the fact that I don't think the general public understands the process. I think you hit on that, the process of the judicial system, the process of victims' rights versus criminals' rights, and the process that, you know, once that offender has served their time and that, I mean, they have done what they were supposed to do. And so by law, they are allowed to be back out on the streets. And that, I think, is the turning point sometimes for victims and their re-victimization, whether it be mentally, physically, spiritually. There is an impact when that offender is released. So what is there resource-wise out there to put into place so that when a victim or their family knows that an offender is being released back into the community, that they can do this ahead of time, make their preparations?
Right. Well, it's a great question, and the reality is that it ranges from not a lot to nothing at all, basically. Now, it depends on the nature of the situation, the crime. It's possible, because the real depth in our work with the advocates, they legally many times are responsible, of course, pre-trial, during trial, to assist victims, and then your prison-based advocates through that system. But after, basically, it's considered, you know, back to norm, because if the person has served their time, then there's really, you know, it's without prejudice, right? It's you move forward. But there can be, like, support groups, you know, great organizations like Parents of Murdered Children that try to cultivate that kind of peer support and mutual support. Sometimes people develop their own local groups, but of course those can vary, can't they, from place to place. But let me tell you a little bit of an anecdote, if I can, just in terms of, you know, how sometimes even a mass media perspective this stuff is missed. I was interviewed by big mainstream media about a particular case where an incarcerated individual, you know, in incarceration he'd gone through that process. I think he'd gained a college degree or some kind of training, and he was going to get out, and he was going to do something considered wonderful. And that was, you know, fine, great. I mean, if a person's getting out, they need to be able to carry on with life in some way, or as we know, they could resort mm-hmm. to, you know, misdeeds once again. So I said, well, you know, that's fine, but my input was, well, what's that person's attitude toward the significantly harmful things that they actually did to the people in the first place? And with all of the stuff that they've now been given free of charge, basically while incarcerated, and of course by parallel, the victims got none of that. The victims don't get to go to college free. They don't get all these access to resources. What is that person going to do to contribute in terms of some form of restitution or restoration? Is that even a consideration? And, you know, the person interviewing me, well, yeah, right, great. And when the article came out in print, it was basically nothing that I'd said in that regard. And, of course, completely ignored. I think I probably barely got quoted because I wasn't saying that this is the greatest thing in the world, that this individual has earned a college degree and is now going to turn around and do something meaningful with his life, okay? And again, I don't take anything away from that as such, but it wasn't in a vacuum. None of that happened in a vacuum. And that's, to me, socially what's missing, that the balanced discussion about the fact that we try to help inmates and the like when they get out to do something and not repeat offense is one dimension, but wow, I mean, the trail that's left for a lifetime is not even in discussion for some people. And, you know, just our very innate sense of fairness, I think, is kind of prodded and picked at, and that's mm-hmm. what we want to do. We just want to ask the question. It's not, you know, continue to beat up on the offender or continue to say the offender has paid his time but he needs to pay more time. It's, wait a minute, if that's going on, how about the victim? So that's why, you know, your program is so important, because it's the lives of people that have been harmed that we need to be supporting and discussing.
Yeah, well, and on the other side of the coin, too, in terms of how does the ex-offender, if they paid their debt to society, how do they, you know, transition and reacclimate? I mean, there are, you know, some resources available, but again, they have a record. How do they get a job? You know, they're discriminated against in terms of housing. So all of those strikes against them, you know, it's just so both factions, I think, are kind of like a fish out of water. And I certainly mm-hmm. felt that way when after, 32 years of incarceration, this multiple murderer could potentially get out and be on the streets again. So it kind of goes both mm-hmm. ways, Will.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and even, you know, I would offer even, you know, we have this, the kind of concept of debt to society, and, you know, I've talked about that before, but, and in a sense, there is an impact on community. We don't, that isn't lost on us, but, you know, 5,000 years ago, with the Code of Hammurabi, that the code actually, in this Babylonian king, he inculcated the idea of victims' rights and responsibility of offenders to victims and restitution and restoration. And mm-hmm. in the formation of our nation, that actually, for a lot of reasons, we won't get into a big history lesson here, but that was lost. And suddenly the focus shifted from basically that the kind of overall debt to society. It's not a debt to an individual. I didn't harm you. I harmed society. That's why prisons, you know, the idea of penitentiary, the root of that is penitence. And historically, the religious notion of paying back, being penitent. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, that's a very different philosophy in some ways. It doesn't have to be fully, of course, but that can be a very different philosophy than saying, hey, you hurt another person. You have a responsibility to do your best to restore what you've taken. Obviously, a person's life lost can't be restored in that sense, but, you know, the responsibility taken. And that many times for me is that's what's missing. And so, you know, again, I add that to the conversation.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I noticed something that you said early, well, actually when we first started the show, that you also have resources for victims of crisis. And I'm looking at your, would this be individual resources or, let's say, resources for the mass victims of this crisis, whatever it might be?
Yeah,
how does
well,
that
we,
work
we,
from here?
Right, well. It's a great question. You know, as the mission statement says, you know, we champion dignity and compassion for those harmed by crime and crisis. So the, you know, big side of the house, of course, is crime victim advocacy. Crisis response commonly comes out typically when we're talking about training. We do a lot of training. We've trained thousands of people in some basic crisis intervention protocols, or as I would kind of frame it, trauma mitigation and education protocols. And sometimes people are they're tasked with going into a situation, and they might have a duty to respond or do other things, you know, from providing basic needs like, you know, passing out water to things, to other kinds of things. And so we've trained people many times who are crisis responders or disaster response relief workers in this, but not just at a mass casualty scale. We trained a lot of groups who are teams, crisis response teams in school districts or in communities. And so those issues, those situations can be driven by a mass casualty crime, or they can be driven by a natural disaster, you know, technological failure and the like. So yeah, it's a great question. That's typically how it comes out on the crisis response side.
Yeah, and you have to be invited in to the situation. You can't just go in like gangbusters, as we said on the other show, right?
Well, that's right. Yeah, we don't go anywhere unless we have an invitation. There are a lot of situations commonly that people self-deploy for whatever reason, and we just don't do that. We have an ethical commitment to say we're there because you want us there, and we have a practical commitment that you show up and, you know, people are going, well, who are you? Why are you here? And then you're really more of a problem to them and trying to manage a crisis. So when we go in, we have to, if we're going to send a team in from our office, which we do on occasion, you know, if it's a high-level, high-profile incident, we're going to need an invitation from somebody in ranking authority so that when we get there, you know, we have some authority to do what we need to do and we know where to go. So that's our standard protocol.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the general public at large has a lot of misconceptions where things like what you've just said, that you have to be invited in. I think when a crisis happens or when a person goes missing, the public who really has never paid attention to that issue before expect mm-hmm. something that just really isn't the reality of it. I know mm-hmm. in working with missing persons, the group that I work with, you have to be invited in either by law enforcement or the family. So it's not, you know, the general public will, you know, criticize because they don't see results or they don't see something happening. Well, not everything happens in the public eye, and I'm sure maybe
that's
you've
right.
run across the same right. thing with Nova.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and indeed we have. I mean, you name a high-profile mass casualty incident, and it's likely that we've been there or people we've trained are involved in that situation, and we commonly have it's a context we call convergence. And convergence is when you have this mass casualty incident, you have a lot of focus for media naturally, so the media converges. And in any given, you know, high-profile situation, you could have, you know, 100, 400 radar trucks, satellite trucks, you know, that converge and park, you know, people around here because it becomes the media story of the day or potentially of the week. Usually even the highest profile ones don't last very long anymore because of the nature of media. And then because of that, you have convergence sometimes of people. They're going to just get in their car and they're going to drive and they're going to do something. They want to help. And I would say, you know, much of it is well-intentioned in many ways, but they honestly don't understand what kind of challenges they're potentially creating for themselves and other people. And then you have the convergence. There's many types of convergence, but you can have convergence where people just start sending things. You know, their hearts are stirred to turn around and make things or do things or send things. And
right.
we're trying very hard, especially working with folks who've gone through this and are now on the back end of that in recovery and are able to speak with strength about what they experienced, because they become, quote-unquote, the experts in talking about their needs. And that is, you know, please don't start sending things. Please don't even definitely don't get in your car unless you've been invited, unless you're trained to do this. But don't converge. Like with, you know, the Virginia Tech horrible tragedy. I mean, they had like 30,000 things that were shipped to them. 30,000,
yeah.
Something like that. And,
well,
you know,
same thing with Newtown, yeah.
Newtown, same. And you know, the folks there won't say this, and so I'll take the risk of offending, you know, some people in your audience, but the folks, they won't tell you this, but they'll tell us privately, you know, this is making our lives very, very difficult. We've got all of these things, and we don't have any place to store them. What are we supposed to do with them? What am I supposed to do with 50 quilts? What am I supposed to do with 400 stuffed animals? You know, and again, everybody knows that it's not that it's mean intended at all, but I think America needs to understand before things happen, what are the ways? Because most people want to do something that's meaningful and helpful, and not knowing, like you just said, they think in their mind, okay, this is probably what should be done since nobody's told me what ought to be done. And, you know, and that's what we're trying to change. We're trying to educate people. Don't react to these situations. And quite honestly, even after the media focus has left, then put it on your list then to follow up and say, okay, I'm going to make my donation 6 months from now, because 6 months from now, the needs
really
are probably more profound than ever, you know?
Yeah. I think there's a parallel there with, you know, people are very giving during the holiday season, and but they forget that there are those needs for, you know, in the summertime,
mm-hmm.
the poor families don't have enough money to feed their children, you know, when school's not there. And, you know, people just rally around the holidays because that is the quote-unquote time of giving. And the same thing when there's a tragedy, but they don't really, you know, it's over for them in 2 weeks in terms of their own mind. And I wrote a blog one time called, "And the Casserole Stopped After 2 Weeks." Because that's, you know, that is the sort of mentality. And then, you know, 6 months, well, you're definitely supposed to be over it by then. And because we don't want to hear about it anymore kind of thing. And, you know, or we're just going to avoid you because you should be over it by now, quote unquote. And but it stays with us forever. And
that's
one of the things that they don't understand. So, yeah, I just, there's so much that the general public needs to know, but, you know, this is the kind of topic where it's not a club you ever want to belong to. And why, unless I have somebody touched by crime in my family or my friend circle or whatever, why would I ever want to know about this? But, you know, Will, I think we're forcing the issue with all of these mass tragedies and, you know, these just randomized killings, you know, people are having to confront it more, and it's becoming more commonplace. So I don't think it's quite as much on the back burner as it used to be. Maybe if any good thing comes out of that, there is a little bit of a raised consciousness. Do you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, anytime we can raise the consciousness and give people meaningful outlets, that's what they need. We all can find ourselves fatigued by stories and media. I mean, you know, in the work, we call it compassion fatigue when we've not really paid attention to the fact that, you know, we're dealing with a lot of these intense situations. And the average person, you know, in just in the public eye, they don't necessarily want to have to deal with this all the time. That's not what they signed up for. But they do, I would contend, based upon what we see in the aftermath of these things, you know, you can see outpourings of things. Well, what if we could help people understand how to steward that outpouring in a longer-term, meaningful way? In other words, it's not, like you're saying, you know, it's not 2 weeks and then it's over. You and I both know that a one-year anniversary of something like that equals 365 days. That's what it equals. It doesn't equal, you know, you're over it now. We commonly say there's no timetable for recovery. Why? Because how do you replace a loss as profound as, you know, your loved one? You don't. There is a hole there, and you don't fill that with something else. Do you learn to cope? Yes, you do. Do you learn to address things? Yes, hopefully. But you don't, quote, unquote, get over it. And I'm, you can't see because we're on the radio, but, you know, big air quotes. You don't get over it. And yeah. You know, that's, if people can just even embrace that and go, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense, then they'll be more sensitive to me in the long run. And they don't have to have thinking about it every day like victims do. But, you know, if they kind of put it in their calendar, well, 6 months from now, I'm going to follow up with my neighbor or I'm going to follow up with my friend and say, you know, how is your grieving going? How are things? How is your coping? You know, that's going to mean a lot right there, in my view.
Yep, definitely. You know, it just seems like it's one person at a time, and sometimes it just kind of gets discouraging to think that is the case, unless you can get people collectively all in one place, such as a NOVA conference, a POMC, you know, survivors of homicide, like whatever it may be. And, you know, I'm for trying to reach out to the masses, and that's part of why we do this radio show. And so, you know, I guess we just have to keep trying. We can't
And you're doing
give
a
up.
Great job at it.
Well, thank you. It's only one of my endeavors here, and I'm hoping people are not radio shy. I don't know why we're not having more people call in. We've had people say, "Oh yes, we're coming," and but who knows? You know, who knows? But
I could have scared them off, frankly.
I don't think so.
So.
You're not scary.
Some people just come late to the party. That's all.
That could be. You know.
Well,
I don't
I'm
know.
The I'm the warm up for your next guest. Okay, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
I'm just.
Oh, is that? Oh, like I wonder who was the warm up for the Beatles.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really? But no. Well, you and Tim are equivalent in my eyes. I didn't say, oh well. You know, you're second bill or whatever. But, you know, just by virtue of you taking this time and being so gracious to do this, and even if we only, in this 1 hour, make this one connection, I think for you and Derek to get connected, I think that's wonderful. So, you know, in
Definitely.
Terms of that, we've accomplished our mission, and I just want to say, too, we did a wonderful, wonderful show from some people in Charlotte, North Carolina, on behalf of National Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month on Saturday. And, yes, there's some very articulate, very intelligent people running a lot of campaigns to address that population, and we just finished a very good show and blog with that. And I want people, if they're too radio shy, to at least go to our website and take a look at that and listen to that show, because that is of epidemic proportions, too, with respect to peer-to-peer violence. You know, that's one thing maybe I should ask you in the last few minutes, too. We kind of categorize our victims. Okay, you last year at the conference, you made a real concerted effort to include in the military, and you have certain themes and whatnot. But how do we, for something like the venue that you have, how do we include the young? You know, I'm not necessarily saying small children, but teens and, you know, into that next decade, because there's so much going on with respect to, you know, cyberbullying and you know, domestic violence and, you know, just all of those kinds of things. Is that something that NOVA may have on tap in the future?
Well, it's a great question. I tell you, first of all, the NOVA conference specifically is for
providers.
Yeah, practitioners. And so we have victim advocates, crisis responders. I will say, though, that we are very open and engaging, particularly for folks who are looking at this as a vocation. For instance, we were in Columbus, Ohio last summer, and some of the local universities, we opened up that door to say, maybe it's a criminal justice program or something like that, and we said, you know, we want you to feel free and come. In fact, we gave them, you know, a free registration for the day if they wanted to come, and some of the students came, and it gave them an exposure to things going on. Now, younger children, adolescent or under 18, I guess it would have to be the person. And I will say, we actually had one of our main keynote presenters was a 17-year-old, and so Ashley Craig is she's an amazing young lady who started an anti-bullying. That's not the greatest word, but, you know, because her thing is about pro-relationships and healthy relationships, but she's a very capable young lady. So, yes, she has amazing capacity. Of course, a lot of it is very adult-oriented in terms of the subjects, the themes, the realities of criminal victimization, but we are definitely open to students and the like. We just want to know who they are and what they're about, particularly in a in an intense training environment. We don't want to victimize anybody or more like traumatize people, and that's what we're usually concerned about, if anything.
Yeah, I understand that. I just feel like all this, all the resources and education should be all inclusive to anyone. And it was just kind of a shame to me that we heard that, the GBLT community, for the teen violence, if you are a same-sex couple in the Carolinas, there are no laws of protection for you per se. And I know with PFAG and other organizations that I've been involved with on a student level, there are nationally for lobbying. But it's just so sad to say that it's so individual in terms of each state. It's kind of, you have to cherry pick in terms of, well, you can get this here, but if you move to this state, it's not available. And, all of these things should be uniform, just like the, constitutional amendment, across the board. Why do we do everything 50 different ways, Will?
Well,
why do we
do that? I want to say that we probably do them 320 million different ways, because that's roughly the population of our country. But I'm being, slightly facetious in that we are independent. Yeah. We're individuals, and yet as the 50 states, that demonstrates our very unique state-based focus. What I would contend is there is in many ways tremendous unity in a very diverse nation founded on the principle of freedom. And yet we wrestle with that, don't we? And that's why the constitutional amendment, in my mind, is so crucial here, is because many are reluctant, resistant to amending the Constitution, as am I, quite frankly. I mean, I tend to be a little bit of a purist there, but at the same time, the Constitution was designed to be amended appropriately. And Madison, James Madison, who was considered, rightly so, the father of the Constitution, he had certain tests that he believed were appropriate to ever considering an amendment. And when we run the victims' rights proposal through that grid of what Madison would consider kind of the test for an amendment, they all pass, because it isn't just about creating a special group of people that doesn't last long. It's about posterity. It's about liberty for human beings, and it's about that group of people who are dragged into the system as victims of crime. So, I won't go too far with that, because you've heard me preach that sermon before. But
Would you want to give the acronym for the website again, if people want to go to the website and sign the petition?
Yes, it's NVCAP, so NVCAP.org.
Uh-huh, right.
Nora and VK. Yeah, I think you got it. Sorry. I've used a lot of my words today. I'm kind of at the end of my verbal quotient, especially after being on the radio with you for an hour. But
we're going to give you a break here now.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a warm-up for Tim, so I'm good with that.
That's good.
And we have Tim on the line, so we can bring Tim in anytime you're ready.
Okay, that's great. Well, what
welcome
do you want
to
say
we're
hi
gonna...
before you leave?
I'd be happy to, yes. I'd be happy to
okay.
say hi.
Okay. Well, bring him on in.
Hey, Donna, hello. How are you?
Tim, hi. It's wonderful to have you. There's a little bit of crossover. Will Marling is right here, and he just wanted to say hello to you before he hands the baton over. So Will Marling of Nova, meet Tim Pombach.
Tim, run. Run fast.
run, yeah. It's too late. They have me.
Yeah,
you were supposed to have... I'm so enamored them that they're just left speechless here, and there's nothing left for me to do but to join the singing.
No, I already know that you've got a lot to contribute to this, so I'm really honored to meet you, quite frankly, and appreciate
you as well.
Donna and Delilah, and of course, I look forward offline, off air, to following up with you too, because they speak so highly of you, and of course that means a lot to me. So
well, you as well, and the work you're doing is the stuff that's near and dear to my heart as well.
Well, very good.
We're going to fill up his conference roster with everybody that calls in, Tim. We're determined.
There you go. You take care of him.
Isn't that great? Okay. Well, Will, thank you so much. I'm putting the check
thank
in the
you,
mail
Will.
Tomorrow. I'm kidding.
You both are wonderful.
Thank you. We will be in touch.
All right. Take good care.
Thank you for
all
what
right.
you do. And yeah. have a good rest of your evening. And,
you
betcha. Okay, we'll see.
Well, Donna, before,
Tim,
before you get too far into everything with Tim, you do have another caller on the line that I would like to bring in first of all, and then we'll go straight into Tim. Here's Dennis N. Griffin.
Oh, my goodness.
Remember Denny Griffin?
I think so, vaguely.
Well, good evening, Donna. How you doing?
Good evening, Denny. Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for calling in. Hey,
you're welcome. We wanted to, Bear and I are here. We wanted to congratulate you on your anniversary.
Well, thank you. It's been a 2-year labor of love working with Delilah on the show, and we're still going strong. I mean, we have our days, but I think overall the high quality of the show and the diversity of the guests, it still keeps going strong. So we can you just tell our audience really briefly, you are part and parcel of me starting this show. You want to tell a little bit about how we did that? And then, you know, you can ask a question if you like of Tim. I know we spent some time with him, or if you choose not, that's fine, whatever.
Yes, I think, Donna, correct me if I'm wrong, we got the brainstorming done while we were on a cruise, what, about 2 years? Well, probably closer to 3 years ago.
Closer to three years now, I know. We have to go on another one.
That's about time, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, and that was how the thing came about, and the show ended up, within a few months, you ended up being on your own blog talk show, so it worked out very well.
Yes, it did, and as I remember, I think Susan Murphy Milano, when she presented it formally, gave me 10 seconds to decide. And it was a yes or no, you know, and so, yeah, and we came up with a title as a result of, you know, us brainstorming on that cruise and everything, which was wonderful. And, hey, can you just give our audience a little bit of a thumbnail sketch about what you're doing right now, because you're so busy out there in Vegas with all your mob activities. Can you bring us up to date? Because we haven't heard from you in forever, you know.
Yeah, so I've been doing some writing projects. I had three more books out, I believe, three or four since we last talked. And I've been doing some ventures in Vegas. I'm involved with a new bus tour, which is called Casino, and it's the real story behind the movie Casino. And I'm involved with Frank Collada, a former lieutenant for Tony Spilotro, in that project. And we also are doing what's called MobCon. That's a law enforcement and mobster convention. We had the first one last September. The next one's going to be this coming September. And that's been very well received. It's going to be a good one, I believe. So we've got several irons in the fire, and most of them are mob-related.
Yeah, and how about the books? Is there any particular one that you've just finished, or would you like to give some contact information if people are interested in finding out what they are?
Sure. The most recent one was December 15th, and that was Hole in the Wall Gang, in my own words, and I authored that for Frank Collada. That's his second book I've done with him, and it's the story about his him and Tony Spilotro's reign in Las Vegas when the Chicago outfit controlled several of the casinos. And the other one is called, that came out in October, is called La Bella Mafia. And contrary to the title, it's not an organized crime book. It's about a woman who was abused physically and sexually by her father and brother from the time she was 4 years old. And it was it's a story of survival. And she is now, in spite of brain injuries and so forth, as a result of beatings, she's started an online support group for abused people, mostly women, and the name of the group is La Bella Mafia. And those books, or all my books, are available through Amazon.com.
Wonderful. Wow. Well, it sounds like you don't have a minute to you don't have a minute to spare, so I really feel very, very pleased that you took the time to call in. But, hey, call me once in a while, will you?
I will do that, Donna R. And, again, congratulations on your on your two-year anniversary, and Bears wants to say congrats.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Bear. How are you?
Fine, honey. How are you doing?
I'm doing just wonderful. We're going to have a private chat one of these days to catch up, okay?
We'd love it. We'd love it. Good talking to you.
Yeah, and good luck with your new pooch there.
Well, thank you very much.
You're
thanks,
welcome.
Thanks, guys,
okay.
And I'll let you get back to your guests. We'll be in touch, Donna.
Okay, very
thank
good.
You.
Thank you, Denny. Thank you, Bear.
Bye-bye.
Tim, thank you for bearing with us through that. I know that you met Denny when we did the two-hour tour there. He's really going great guns with respect to his authorship career. And we haven't connected in quite a while, but it's always good to have that, you know. What I'd like to start out with, and do we have somebody waiting in the wings, Delilah?
Yes, you do have somebody. I mean, do you want to take another call now, or do you want to go into what Tim's
Well, you know what I'd like
to talk about?
Tim, why don't we have Tim tell us, because that might spur some more calls as well. Tim, you have been doing some very intriguing research, and I want to give you the opportunity to tell our audience, because we have some people that are very invested in the field of human trafficking as well. So if the caller wouldn't mind to hang on, please don't hang off, because we love you. I'd like to have you explain some of the activities that you're doing, Tim. Would you mind?
Sure. No. And hey, congratulations. It doesn't possibly seem that this is 2 years.
I was one of your
earlier guests, and the fact that you're on for 2 years makes me feel good, like I didn't totally destroy your show in one episode. So hopefully I won't be responsible for your demise tonight either.
No, I don't think so. We've had Elaine Pagliaro, we've had Pete Valentin on twice, so we've had the whole family on.
You got some good people there. So
I know, so... Thank you.
Before I answer your question, this is going to kind of be like the qualifications they've been putting out every day. If you're into the Olympics and you don't want to have the night ruined, and they say turn off the TV quickly. So I'm going to tell people, unless you're prone to have your heart torn in one direction and be interested in something that will give you many sleepless nights, turn the radio off and go do something different. and I don't really mean that because I know it will hurt you, but this is this is one of those subject matters, unless you're like a really cruel, indifferent, or strangely complicated person, the more you know, the more it will disturb you, and the more it will empower you, and the more it will make you crazy, mad, angry, or any and all of the above, which is more or less the journey I've been on for about 5 years. So for the callers who don't know me, I mean, my real gig is currently as a forensic scientist, and I retired 9 years ago, believe it or not, which is crazy. That happened, too, from the state of Connecticut, Department of Public Safety, where my last tour was as a lab director, and before that was in the major crime unit. And so that's more my, you know, forensic law enforcement is my back, my love, my passion still is. But somehow these dots came connecting very clearly within about 2 years ago in the world of human trafficking. And what was wildly amazing to me is I began to understand, you know, how big this problem is. And, you know, there's numbers all over the place, and all we can agree on is that the numbers are probably insufficient and inadequate anyway. But we're talking about, you know, 29+ million people currently enslaved in some form or another, whether it be sexual exploitation or labor trafficking or debt bondage or combinations of it. And I mean, so if you want to put a perspective on that, you know, the entire African slave trade, which was absolutely horrific and horrible and a terrible scar in American and worldwide history, over the decade that occurred, it we're talking 50,000 people. So we're talking a current snapshot of today is in the neighborhood of 29 million. So if that, you know, right away, the scope of this is just ridiculously just nuts. And my quest came to this. I said, well, what are we doing about it, and how can that possibly be, and why are those numbers there? And so I started looking at it from my angle, which is, you know, using forensic science and all that we have to offer to solve some of these cases. And the more I researched, the more I found out nothing. And so I said, yeah, well, okay, I'm doing something wrong, and I got some grad assistants involved and talked to some of my colleagues and say, okay, I'm kind of a science nerd, so maybe I'm missing the whole social science thing. Tell me, you know, what am I not doing? Why am I not finding the answer to what we've been doing to solve these cases? And the long answer, the short answer, every answer is nothing. And so, you know, worldwide, the amount of effort we put into this problem, the amount of arrests, the amount of prosecutions, honestly, God, we can count on one hand and have a few fingers to spare. It's an embarrassment. It's disgusting. It's ridiculous. It's unacceptable. It's all of that. And so I began my quest into, you know, what do I know? What can I do to make a difference? And for me, the answer was looking at DNA and some of our powerful tools. And so that will lead us into where we'll go, hopefully, tonight. And certainly anything else your guests would have to ask.
Wow. Okay. Well, that certainly sounds, you know, you are on a mission. And I'm very confident that if anyone can, you know, make a dent in this issue, you and your colleagues can. And we have some very dedicated colleagues, too, that are doing some very good work. So maybe everyone puts their heads together. 29 million to them, that's just incredible. You know, it really, really is. But I'm sure maybe we have some people that do have some questions with regard to that. But Delilah, do we have a particular person that has a question for Tim?
This would be a good time to go ahead and bring on our next caller.
Okay.
Go ahead, caller.
Well,
Diane.
Hello, Donna. This is Diane.
Diane Tomasetti, how are you?
I'm good. I'm afraid I don't have any questions for your fellow who just spoke, although he sounds fascinating, and I applaud all of his focus and work, for heaven's sakes. Absolutely.
Well, thank you. You know, I have to tell the audience that you have been part of our Shattered Life family as well, because not only do we do things that are focused on crime and disability and sometimes DBLT, but we also have had a few shows in health and wellness, and you came under that category, and your guest house is a little slice of heaven in Massachusetts, and that's what your show was all about, and it was vastly popular. And I thank you so much for what you did with respect to bringing that issue to the fore, and it still is enjoyed to this day. And you know, we've known each other for many, many years in many capacities, and it's just always a joy to talk to you. And I'm so pleased that you're calling in, and I'm honored. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome, but I thought I'd give you a little update, Donna. Bag & Zen Guest House is no longer in business.
Oh,
I actually have sold the house, and the business is closed. And, Donna, I moved to Hawaii, and I am at this moment sitting here in Hawaii,
on the
farthestmost garden island. And
you are.
That's where I am now, and I am not going to be starting a new bed and breakfast out here, although I'm in the process of buying a house.
But it will not
be for a bed and breakfast.
Well, we all know how about
that dramatically. Yeah,
really?
Dramatically.
And Tim, Diane was one of the few female hot air balloon pilots in the Connecticut area as well, and she introduced us to this. So this is a very adventurous woman. She can do anything.
Oh, for real? Did you do it? Did she talk you into going up?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yes.
Excellent.
Yeah, she had that business for forever, but real estate, she can build houses, she can do anything. Diane, I'm so jealous. You're sitting there in Hawaii right now. Oh, my goodness.
I am sitting here in Hawaii right now. In fact, I'm watching a couple of folks get paddleboard lessons. I'm sitting down by Kaupaki Beach. And,
really?
This is now my permanent and primary residence, Kauai.
Oh, my God. Well, I wish you all the – you know, we never got to do our radio show at Bag & Zen, so Delilah and I have to come and visit you in Hawaii.
Well, I think you will. I will have – as soon as I close on this house, I will have room for you guys. You come out here and we'll do a beach broadcast. Absolutely.
Oh my God. That would be wonderful. We're going to hold you to that one. Wow.
Right.
Well,
I do know a lot of folks that stayed at the guest house. Who had become friends are looking to come out here as well. As I said, I'm not doing a bed and breakfast, but I will have space for some folks to come out and stay in.
Oh,
you never
my
know.
God. Well,
my phone number is the same.
Yes. Okay.
And you've got my email, Donna.
Yes, I do. Well, I will be in touch with you, and I just wish you all the best, and I know you're going to make a success in whatever you're doing there. So we will carry on. Thank you. Thank you. I love you for calling in and being so
consistent. Congratulations.
Okay.
This is 2 years. I think it's fabulous, and you just keep
thank
right
you.
On, Donna. You are great at this, and thanks so much. I'll talk to
you
again.
You take care, Diane. Very good.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, my goodness. I started out, just to let people know a little bit, way back in the dark ages, I was a medical speech-language pathologist, and Diane was my first supervisor as a speech pathologist. So she's been through many, many, many changes in her life, and she always makes a big success. So I have to say that has been part of the uplifting theme of Shattered Lives, too. She's been through hard times, and she has always made a success of her life. So she's one of my favorite people, and I'm so glad she called in. So now we can get back to crime, though, I think. Delilah, wasn't that a surprise?
That was a wonderful surprise, yeah.
Oh, my God. And we have an invitation to Hawaii.
Yes, you do.
Yes, we do. So... do we have anybody in the cave there for Tim?
No,
at
not
this,
right
at
now.
This particular
so
moment?
No. I'm nope. really interested to hear what Tim's been up to with globally with the DNA project and human trafficking. How does this go together, Tim?
Yeah.
How is that working?
Yeah. So I'll tell you as much as I can, and it's as concise as a matter as I can. The good news is, after a year-long project, it is working. And that was right away. Everybody was skeptical, saying this is kind of nuts. And I'll explain to you what we're doing, and you can kind of tell me that, Tim. That's kind of nuts. But we'll explain why it worked. So my boss, he's awesome, so I'll give him the kudos he needs, but Dean Mario Gabri, who has much more background than I ever did in this world, victimology is what he's a specialist in, and he's published in this, right. And he's done so much in it, and was part of the early Bush administration down at the Octum of Victims. And so when I explained to him this was my concern, he said, "Hey, let's. I got your back. Go do this." And so I actually was not here last year. I was on sabbatical, and I was spending most of my time overseas. And so my tour de jour, as it were, was it started out in Latin America, mainly through Costa Rica, bounced over to the Nepal, India area. Then I jetted back west a little bit, banged a quick left, and went south through the Balkans. And then ended this tremendous escapade down in the eastern part of Africa. Each and every one of those has got some great adventure stories, some that I hope to God nobody will ever hear, that I'll never admit to, and others I'll be glad to tell you. But the common theme in each of these places, and it's a common theme everywhere, yes, including America, is that there's just a huge amount of extremely vulnerable, mostly women and children, bottom line, some men for sure, and that includes boys in there. But we're tending to talk about those people in this world who've already gotten a pretty crappy deal, whether they're stuck in poverty or war-torn areas or life as a refugee, they already had a pretty bad deal. And then they're just outright victimized through a whole variety of different mechanisms. And one of the other stats I didn't throw at you, but I need to throw it out, what's driving this is money. And right now, if you look at the world of organized crime and corruption, and illicit activities in the world, still drugs is the top kingpin there, but human trafficking is coming, racing up to make a race out of that. And the only other thing that's in play is the illegal sale of weapons, mainly because of all the armed conflicts and wars. That's what's driving that. So, and most everybody says within a very short period of time, the number two position for illegal money and activities will be human trafficking, and everybody sees the opportunity for that to surpass drugs. So I think, honestly, once we get there, we're almost at the point of no hope, because there'll be so much money, so much organized criminal, governmental, corrupt governmental backing behind it. Our ability to break in and make a change is going to be almost impossible. And so if you ask me some of my goals of my ultimate project, our number one goal was to take the power and the might of these tools, namely forensic DNA analysis, and break him over the back of the criminal network that's making a living on this. Do we want to liberate the women and children? Yes. Do we want to close down brothels? Yes. But that in and of itself is not the answer. The answer is going to be to bust these networks up. And in order to do that, we got to use our best. And that's my frustration. We have these great tools. Why haven't we been doing it? And so that's the nutshell from what we started doing. I'd be glad to, want to talk about a specific country or an issue. I'd be glad to. Maybe I'll let you bounce an idea off me, and you can tell me where you're concerned, frustrated, or want to hear more.
So why is it that the emphasis seems to be on the other end of the spectrum? The victim certainly isn't important, but in order to shut this down, you shut down the demand, some people say, whereas your take on it is, if we can get the DNA for the big kingpins and incarcerate them, then we're breaking up the big groups, and that's our best contribution.
So let me. You're spot on with this. Let me answer, I think, two prongs. What you said. Number one, let's look at supply demand economics. I guess I just say it, men are men. So are we going to solve? And I say that as a member of that subgroup, and with a fair amount of shame. The demand side isn't going to go away, and that would be nice if it would, but for whatever reason, this and say, and don't even get me going, because I, you know, the concept of having sexual relations with a kid is so beyond anything that I can even humanly dream about as making sense, that don't even ask me. I,
right.
You know, I have nothing to say about that. But the concept just of sexually exploiting women and children in general, it's just so inappropriate. And I wish I could say that we could find a mechanism to change the behavior, mostly of men, but I don't know that that's going to happen in any time short. And the supply side is also a problem. You know, there is so many of these individuals caught in poverty and despair and you know, social, political turmoil, that the opportunity is just there. So our traditional models are not going to work. And many of the efforts to stop trafficking are focused on either side of that equation. And I commend them for the work. They're brave. They're courageous. They're doing awesome things. I just don't think at the end of the day that's going to make the total difference. And so that's this kind of newer approach of, well, let's look at it as a big business model. Let's go after that network with everything we got. Let's take the network out. And from that, we'll have our greatest impact. Now, next mm-hmm. aspect of this, DNA really has two valuable prongs here. One is actually victim-centered. One of the realities of what these traffickers do to these people is they strip them of their personal identity. They take their name away. They take their passport away. They take their family connection away. You can't take somebody's DNA away, even if you kill them. That's there. You can't alter it. You can't change it. You can't sell it. You can't morph it. It is what it is. It always will be, from the day you were born till the day you die, and you know, and continue on in your bones, in the grave, in the ground for, you know, generations to come. So that's an identity that we can take advantage of, and we can use that to uh-huh. you know, permanently track where these girls go, where do they come from, who's your kinship, you know, are you, you know, this guy Uncle Charlie that's bringing them over the border, are you really Uncle Charlie? You know, let's see, we'll prove it, and I'll talk to you later on about some new technologies that are just blow your mind in the DNA world
yeah.
that allow us to actually do this in a matter of about 80 minutes.
Really?
So that's the first use. The second use is, again, let's use it as evidence in the trial against the perpetrators. You know,
mm-hmm.
right
mm-hmm.
now, one of the reasons it's so difficult to get prosecutions besides the will to do so is how do you take a 14-year-old girl, you know, who parents, you know, sold her by deception or by choice, you know, into a situation which everybody thought was going to be good, and the next thing you know, she's raped, drugged, beaten down, and in a brothel 365 days a year, and you yank her out of that mess, you know, 2 years later with no hope, no future, afraid of everybody, trusting no one, and say, oh, by the way, now we're going to put you in this thing called a court, and you're going to get prosecuted, you know, you're going to get cross-examined and grilled, and we really need you to testify and tell us exactly what happened, and do it succinctly and powerfully, and don't get confused, and don't trip up, and then maybe we'll get a conviction. That's just not fair. It's not realistic to me either. But if we could use DNA to establish, hey, you know what? We'll show that you were in that location. You know what? We'll also show that seven other men were in that location. And we might even find body fluids that will substantiate. I should probably also give it, you know, PG-13 warning here. Sorry. But we'll
yeah.
find some body fluids that will help us talk about some of the activities that took place there. So we can bolster that victim and his or her testimony with you know, unbiased, tangible, you know, solid physical evidence. So those are two prongs of why I think it's powerful.
Wow. Now, Tim, why has someone not taken this approach before you?
I don't know. I mean, there's some really minor examples that are out there. There's an organization called DNA Pro Kids. They're awesome. They're Jose Laurentia out of University of Granada in Spain and Dr. Artie Weisenberg out of University of North Texas really joined in on this group, and they focused using DNA specifically to clean up the bad adoption business. It's a, you know, and they had a project. They went down to Guatemala and they went into the orphanages and the social service centers and kids on the street. And anywhere where they saw a kid in any of this capacity or kids getting ready for adoption, they took their DNA sample. And then they used police and social workers and other people to say, bring us back to families, any family in the same general area that's either missing a child or believes that they put a child into the adoption system. Well,
mm-hmm.
they garnished slightly less than 10,000 samples. And I love to ask this question. So out of those 10,000 samples, how many samples do you think, you know, ultimately identified a child that was either outright kidnapped or illegally put into the adoption system?
Oh, my God. I just can't imagine them either going to way high or low.
Give me a shot.
Nearly 90% or something.
That's a big shot. I mean, when I first heard this presentation, I'm thinking 40, 50. The answer is 2,700, I mean, which is staggering. So 2,700
out of how many? 10,000?
Out of 10,000.
Wow, that's so cool. Wow.
It's a big number.
That is staggering.
It's a big number. So that was wildly successful, and it showed the power of this unbiased tool called DNA. So, and actually, we are joining forces with them. We're talking about, hey, let's do projects together. Let's enhance what you're doing. Add to it. And so, really, right now, here's my big pitch. Everybody gets a big pitch. I don't have a book or anything like that. But we're in the moment negotiating for some large funding sources to expand the scope of this work, which is obviously the point that we're at. So we're going to working with that place, DNA Pro Kids, to do some of that work throughout the country. But that's just one small example of the little bit that's being done out there. I am delighted, that it seems like some of our federal government agencies, the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, are getting more and more interested in this, are seeing the value of things like DNA evidence and seem to be moving this back to the front burner and a focal point, and very much so domestically. So, I think as much as I say nothing was done, and I think we're just on the starting curve, I'm also feeling really good about what I see as a momentum building here, and I think maybe we're all on the road to really turning the corner here.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you feel that as a result of working with these couple of organizations, like you said, one was in Spain, but in terms of the U.S., you've been over in foreign countries. Do you see this also just expanding, a hundredfold in terms of applying what you did over there here in the U.S.?
Yes. So let me talk first about my experience over there. In all those countries, we certainly made contact with government officials. I mean, we're not like some kind of rogue, wild guys that just show up and play investigator. So we always dealt with the local governments and our government or State Department, whoever was around, and said, this is what we want to do and this is what we're here for. And we ended up meeting with presidents of the country, prime ministers, attorney generals, ministers of justice, U.S. embassy ambassadors. I mean, we got, really good access and good audience. And in every single country, as we explained this initiative and this concept, it was extremely welcome. They're like, yes, we get it. It makes sense. Bring it. Come. And unfortunately, the frustrating part is mostly it's now a matter of resourcing, of us trying to develop the necessary resources to help each and every one of these countries start moving this initiative down the field, and that's kind of a key part of where I am. I think the next several years is going to be kind of my, get out there on the road and be an ambassador and try to spread the message and the news and get the funding streams individually in each of these countries.
Well,
but now you ask,
are you looking to put a team together, Tim? I mean, I have a few people in the back of my head that I may be able to turn your way that have experience in foreign relations and human trafficking both.
Yeah, I've never, that's not our number one goal right now. We actually have some NGO groups, some experienced personnel, some other, practitioners who are over in the field, other forensic science personnel. So the answer is always anybody wants to be interested in doing this work, let's figure out where we can use them because we can use them, And to the extent their skill fits with our mission, that's great for sure. Yeah.
Well, I'll try to work out some introductions for you then.
Absolutely.
Oh,
I think unfortunately we're just at the point now where we have multiple countries, and there's three more countries, two in Europe and one in Latin America, that have requests into us. Come on down, talk to us, and see if we can't implement the plan there. So the contacts seem to be there. The interest is there. We believe we can ramp up our organizational structure as quick as we need to within reason to meet most of those needs. And so we're, Yeah, I hate to say it again. I mean, we're kind of at that, you know, we're at that, you know, are we as a country or private foundations or whatever, are we ready to fund this and help these countries? And part of this, frankly, in my opinion, these countries also have to do, this is their home. You know, I don't think it's appropriate for foreign government just to say, hey, you, U.S., you need to pay and do all this, because I don't think that's right. It's important to them, prove it's important to them, and step up to the plate with your own resources, and we'll see what you can do to help them.
So you're at that point of trying to raise money or waiting for the federal government to, with grants and et cetera?
We're doing all of that and then some, yes, right? And it's going to be, unfortunately, it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all. I think almost every country's got a different strategy necessary for to build a sustainable long-term model that's funded. And so that's the fright. So, hey, you want to get some volunteers, but that's the stuff we could, you know, I can't tell you how much time we spend doing that kind of work, which is just so laborious, you know. That's where it's a gift being at a university. You know, we have granting officers and people who are doing just a ton of work helping us do this. But that's a big part of the project and just extremely time-consuming.
Yeah. Well, Donna, I would like to bring in another caller at this time real quick, if this is a good time to take a little bit of a break, okay? Welcome,
sure.
Jeff Mudgett. Hey, Jeff.
Donna,
yes.
How are you?
Hi,
Donna, how are
I'm
you?
Fine. I'm fine. Thank you so much for calling in. Jeff, it's always an honor and a pleasure to have you. I'm one of your biggest fans. Tell Tim who about your affiliation and who you are in case he's not aware, because I think he'd be very interested.
You know, I hate to interrupt your discussion. I was fascinated listening to it.
Well,
I wish
sure.
it would have gone on, but I needed
well,
the opportunity
can.
To I wanted to congratulate you on your two-year anniversary. I just think it's spectacular what you've done. And the two shows I've been on with you, I'll always remember them. They were some of my favorite.
Well, thank you. Mine as well. And, you know, you certainly are, a very unusual character. It was a pleasure to be able to write about you. And, you know, I don't know many people who are featured on the History Channel are going to have a Hollywood movie and all of those kinds of things. So, but on the other hand, you're a very down-to-earth kind of guy for everything that's occurred in your life and, you know, how crime has touched it. And, you know, it's just an honor to have you as part of our guest list here. So thank you
well,
so
as
much.
Far and, as bringing our listeners up to speed as to who Jeff is, because we haven't even
right.
gone there. Jeff Mudgett is the great-great-grandson of H.H. Holmes, who was one of America's first serial killers in Chicago back in 1880-something or other, and he can tell you. But he is also the author of the book Bloodstains, which tells about his experience in learning this fact after he was, what, I'll let you tell it, Jeff. You do it so much better than I do.
I don't know.
And it was proven by DNA, Tim.
I'm fascinated. Keep telling me a story. I mean, yeah, this is.
Go ahead, Jeff.
All right. Well, Bloodstains is about when I was about 40 years old, my grandfather coming clean with a secret to the entire family at dinner, that we were the direct descendants of probably the most evil man that ever lived, the devil in the White City, and how that knowledge changed my entire life, this quest that became an obsession and then had to be a struggle for the rest of my life, and how knowing the truth and history has made my life better when for many years I thought it was a horror. And I just, I like my readers to dig into the book and step into my shoes and see what would happen in their own lives if their grandfather had told them such a horrible secret. And right now we're looking at, tomorrow I get to meet, as you said, Donna, with some Hollywood producers who want to make a movie of the book, starring big names that just incredulous movie stars. And I'm going to go nod my head and agree to everything they say. This being my first book, I've had two or three of my author friends give me advice about not complaining about the movie, not turning out exactly as the book was and all that. So but I'm thrilled to go listen to see how they're going to do it. We've got one of Hollywood's most famous writers right now, Jeffrey Reddick, who's going to put it all together for the studios, and I just can't wait to see what they come up with.
Well, yeah, maybe you can
exciting.
Tell me a little bit about the aspect of the proof with DNA and the Mansion of Horrors and whatnot. I mean, Tim, they proved this beyond the shadow of a doubt that he is the direct descendant.
Through DNA evidence?
Yeah, and genealogical studies. I mean,
yep.
It's my grandfather's grandfather. It's pretty
yep.
easy to nail down. There's been three or four people who've denied it for a while, but they gave up on that. And without forgiving me, obviously, how that works in our country now. But, no, that's all true. When he was about 27, 28 years old, he built the murder castle. It wasn't called that at the time. But he had guests come that were going to the World's Fair in Chicago, the 20, 30, 40 million people from all over the world that visited. He built this castle in between the junctions for the railroad so that when they got into Chicago and they had to make transfer over to the World's Fair, they had to go by the hotel, and many of them did it at night, and they had to stay somewhere for their most incredible day of their lives the next morning. Well, unfortunately for many beautiful young women who he decided he wanted to experiment upon, the castle was built so that he could asphyxiate them, send them down the chutes, and then his assistants would strap them to gurneys, and he murdered hundreds in this hotel in America, in Chicago, and most people just can't believe that could have been true in our country. And the book's about going to that place now, which it was torn down in 1937. A post office was built over its top, but there's some of the original portions of the basement still there, and the post office people let me go down into this basement, and the book's about what I felt, what I saw, and what I heard down basement, that they had closed up for about 20 years because the employees there thought it was quote-unquote haunted. So the History Channel then followed me down. It was it's on Haunted History. A full hour of them following me down into the basement and talking about homes and that history of America, which many mm-hmm. people don't know about. But it's a good show, so if you get a chance, take a watch.
Yeah, and isn't this film going to be different than the original film, Jeff?
Well, what they've told me is they're actually thinking of making three movies of the book because they don't want to have to cut it up so much that it's not understandable to the viewer. So I think what they're talking about, Donna, is the first part will be about me learning who this man was, having my grandfather give me the tackle box and the diaries, and then going mm-hmm. back and forth a little bit in time explaining the story. Mm-hmm. Then the second part, I've been trying to get them to have the courage to discuss and put it on the movie that he probably was also Jack the Ripper. And they've been going through the evidence I have, which is very exciting to explain it to them. And then the third part will be more of a prelude to maybe even a sequel. So I don't know anything about movies. I've never produced a movie. I've never even sat at a movie studio. So I'm quite mm-hmm. excited about tomorrow. It's an adventure in life.
Wow. Well, that is so exciting, but while you have the opportunity and Tim's expertise, is there a question that you might have for him with regard to your experience and if he can answer anything?
You know, I came on about 5 minutes before you put me on and you were discussing a subject that wasn't quite related to the book, so if Tim wants to jump in, I'd be glad to have a discussion, but he's going to have to help me out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it definitely sounds. I mean, sounds interesting to me. You know, and it's again the power of DNA confirmed for you something that was only speculative, and it's wonderful when science can shut up all the naysayers, you know, so concisely.
Well, here's
yeah,
your
isn't
now,
that incredible,
now
Tim? Yeah.
Yeah, now you've got me going, Tim. What we're going to try to do in the book, I discuss how it's my belief that a prison guard was hung in his place. And Dory of H.H. Holmes, the incredible book by Eric Larson, The Devil in the White City, the history of this horrible man was that he was hanged while in prison in Philadelphia. my belief, having tracked him down piece by piece, was that a prison guard was hanged in his place, and then that body was encased in a 10-foot block of concrete. Well, when we get permission, Tim, we're going to exhume that grave, that concrete. The Smithsonian's already said they're going to take possession of it when it comes out of the ground. Then their experts are going to compare the remains as DNA with my tissue to see if it is him or indeed the prison guard.
Oh, that'd be fascinating. Yeah, I encourage you to put,
isn't that cool?
Yeah. Put together a full exhumation team. I've done maybe 6 or 7 different really interesting high-profile ones. And because, you do a lot more. I mean, through some of our innovative methods, I'm not going to say you can conduct a full autopsy, but we might be able to help determine the actual cause of death and, was it really a hanging or was it a faked hanging or, other injuries or maybe he was drugged first or so there's so much we can learn so even so many years later through an exhumation process. That, and there's your fourth book, by the way.
Well, Tim, it sounds like it was lucky that I got to meet you tonight. What else we're doing? That story that was over the news the last 2 weeks about the 53 bodies in Florida at the young boys' school?
The federal government
required them to close that school down so that those
it was an orphanage or something.
Yeah. So that those bodies could be ID'd because there is no statute of limitation on murder. Well, I'm going to take everything they did there and then I'm going to apply it to the federal government and demand that they do the same at 63rd and Wallace, because I think there's as many as 200 or 300 murders there that were never ID'd, and that just because the federal government owns the land doesn't mean they shouldn't do the same thing they make other schools do, the one in Florida particularly.
That's very interesting. You're going to need a certain level of proof.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at the post office.
So underneath the what used to be the murder castle is now a post office, Tim. So if they excavate under that building, you're predicting there's 200 or 300 more.
Oh, yeah. There was in this basement, there was acid baths and there were furnaces. The man knew that, all serial killers were caught because of remains. He was an expert at removing those remains. He used to sell the skeletons all across the country to medical schools. As a matter of fact, about 8 months ago, we had a medical school in Iowa contact me and say they were removing that skeleton from their school because they thought it was sold to them by Holmes. So he was an expert at that. And that DNA, as Tim would be able to explain to your listeners, it's all there in that ground. It just has to be done scientifically.
Well, yeah, it's absolutely worth the inquiry. I mean, depending upon, what acids he's using and to the extent that he incinerated him, this may not be that easy of a task. But, it's amazing how far our technology's come. It's worth the effort.
So
yeah.
That's interesting. So if it was in a furnace, the DNA is still, it doesn't exist past the fire?
Well, your best
in
shot's
the
probably going to be the pulp of the teeth. The teeth, the porcelain of the teeth are pretty resistant to extreme temperatures, so that may be the shot. I'd say clearly your tissue, your muscle mass is gone, and most of your bones may be equally incinerated, so hair would be gone. So it may be down to just whether we can come up with some teeth out of those incinerated remains, but there's really no way to know that until you kind of get in there and start looking.
Yeah, so I'm going to put all that together. I'm just going to parallel what the federal government did with that orphanage in Florida, and then I'm going to present the papers to them in Chicago and D.C. and demand that they do something with those unsolved murders that occurred there.
Yeah, and, there's plenty of people in our community that would be willing to help you out with that. So, that's certainly an intriguingly interesting forensic case for sure.
Isn't it, Tim? I know. I just love to connect people. If there's a way that, the two of you collaborate, even just the exchange of a question here or there, if there's other people helping you, I just love to do that. But it is a fascinating case, isn't it, Tim?
Absolutely.
Very much
yeah.
so.
I certainly knew a little bit of the case once you mention the name, for sure.
But you'll have to get his book and read all about it.
I will. No doubt I will. Yeah.
Yes. Well, we can send you that information, or Jeff can, Jeff?
No problem at all. And
we have it, have his work email. You can send it.
Yeah,
Donna, I'm going to let you and Tim finish off the show. I hate to interrupt, but I had to get in and congratulate you on the success of your show, because it's something I take a lot of pride in helping you with, and you're an amazing host on these shows, and I can't wait to see where it ends up.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your comments, and you're such a good guy and a good friend, and thank you again, and we will talk to you soon, and thank you for adding a really good, nice dimension to the conversation with Tim. Very intriguing. So I think we've got about 10 minutes left. If people still want to call in or in the chat room and ask Tim questions, we've got 10 more minutes before he's off doing his next duty. He doesn't.
Donna, before you, we have a couple calls. We have actually two in line right now. So if you want to get these in real quick, because we are running out of time. So hold on.
See that? See that? Okay, let's
see
that.
Hello, caller. Welcome to Chattered Lives. Go ahead. You're on the air.
This is you, Lil Alonso Garza from Mothers and Mannequins Gangs in California, and I just want to congratulate Lady Justice, and also,
hi, Yuri. Yes.
Hello.
How
I
are you?
Congratulate you and thank you. You know, and also to Tim from Nova for advocating for victims like my family and my son. And what you guys are doing is just amazing, and giving us a place where we can actually voice our concerns and also to express, you know, what we feel as victims of a violent crime.
Well, it's a pleasure. Tim is actually with the Henry Lee Institute, but, you know, we're all in the same family. We do. Yuri is actually, just to give people a preview, she is going to be on our show this coming Saturday and give us an update, because she founded a wonderful grassroots organization for mothers and fathers against gangs when her son tragically was in the wrong place at the wrong time and killed by a gang member. And she has just done wonderful things. And I believe that there was a court hearing that's just recently taken place. Yuli, is that right?
Yes, actually, we're in the process of going through one continuance after another continuance after another continuance, and we understand that, you know, it's a process that needs to take place in order to get to the justice for our son and for our family, but, you know, it's been a year and one month since my son's passing, and, you know, thankfully, you know, unlike other families that have murdered children that don't have a person that's incarcerated, our son's murderer was caught within a day of the incident and has been incarcerated since the day after my son died. And, you know, we just keep praying and hoping that the wheels of justice on earth will also coincide with what God's, you know, plan is.
Well, we hope that, too, and we're looking forward to having a more detailed update. And I can't thank you enough, because you have such a strong community that rallied for you down in the Imperial Valley, San Diego area. And the first show we did was hugely successful. So we look forward to talking to you again on Saturday. And thank you so much, Yuli, for calling in and wishing us congratulations. It really means a lot to us. So I'll be talking to you soon, okay?
Thank you very much. Have a great
day. Okay.
Thank
you,
Yuli.
Bye-bye. Do we have another person, Delilah?
We do. We have Bob Ron from Management Resources in New York.
All right.
Hey, Bob.
Hi, Donna. How are you? Congratulations.
Hey, Bob. I'm well. Thank you. It's a nice surprise to have you call in. And, hey, I want you to be able to take advantage. And would you happen to have a question for Tim Pombach?
actually, I don't. I wasn't prepared for it.
That's
sorry
okay.
About that.
I thought you were off guard.
You know what? I just walked in the door. I was out doing the surveillance, and I wanted, you know, I wanted to just get on the line and say congratulations before, you know, before the show was over. You know, Kim and I wanted to wish you the best, and again, you know, congratulations.
Wow.
You're doing a great job.
Thank you so much. You know, it's been a labor of love and very rewarding, and we're still doing it. I don't know how long until you know, one of my other endeavors just blossomed. We'll keep doing it for a while because we do a very good service for a lot of people, even though sometimes we might not get as much feedback as we like, you know, I know that we're doing good. And for good people like Tim and Will to come up and volunteer their time, it just speaks volumes about, you know, how many people out there really do help victims. And so, I just want to say, Bob, this is taped, so you'll be able to hear Tim's dialogue with respect to what he's doing with DNA and human trafficking. It's just fascinating. So I hope you'll tune in on the archives as well. But thank you so much for your well wishes. And, go ahead.
No, you're very welcome, and I will listen. You know, I will listen to the archives. I'd be very interested in hearing about the DNA.
He's doing some very great things, and like I say, if you happen to have anything, I can always pass on questions. If people were too shy to come on the air or the chat room, I can always pass on some questions to him. I know, you know, some people don't like to be on the air, but I'm a chatty Kathy. So thank you, Bob, so much. I appreciate it. Give our best to Kim as well, and I'll be in touch with you. Okay?
All right, very good. And once again,
all right, very good. All right,
all right.
Take care of yourself.
All right, you
Kim,
too.
I'm
bye-bye.
Gonna, yeah, okay, we'll see you, Bob. Tim, I'm going to give you the last couple of minutes. Would you like to impart a parting message to us about your work or anything else in particular? We'd love to close out with some of your inspiring words.
Well, so just one more technical thing, and then I'll try my darndest to be inspiring. You know, I kind of alluded to it,
okay,
the new technology change. And so here's it in a nutshell. It's a thing called rapid DNA analysis. And what historically took us a month to do and what traditionally still takes us multiple days to do, you know, in five separate rooms in a modern forensic lab, can now be done with a desktop plug-in-the-wall instrument run by an operator with, you know, not an extensive amount of training, and we'll get a full DNA profile in under an hour and a half. And
seriously? Wow.
Seriously,
wow.
Yeah. Now, this is new technology. We got more, you know, more concordance and validation studies, but everything is in the go. It's working. One of our goals was to go, you know, some of the places we were in were horrible. You know, people said, oh, how wonderful, you're going to, I said, wait a minute, time out. You know, the places I'm going to are, number one, not necessarily where you don't want to go, but when you get there, you know, and you go to the State Department webpage or whatever, and they say, under no circumstances should you go there, that's where we go. So we were in the worst of the worst, dealing in some really tough places, and so our ability to get this evidence and analyze it and do it, you know, in a matter of hours was really wildly encouraging for us. You know, we're just excited now. I mean, I hope that your listeners, no matter whether they're, you know, completely in the victim's center aftercare model or wherever their walks of life are, that, you know, there's an opportunity for them to make a difference in this battle against human trafficking, even if they're just willing to talk about it. And, and you know, the time's come. I mean, we just need to admit it, accept it, understand there's some good solutions out here, you know, get people with their professional skills in the game, as it were. I mean, you know, whether you're an entrepreneur or an attorney or a medical practitioner or a plumber, or you pick it, there's a way that you can get involved. And so I hope that some capacity it resonated in these individuals' hearts. There's no such thing as a victim more deserving than another. By any means, all victims share that terrible common tragedy. But I will advocate for the many who, you know, have not had a voice and are out there desperate for an opportunity to be heard. And so I hope I can be a small part of that.
Well, I think you're a large part of it. I beg to differ. After all these years and every capacity, I just wanted to ask one last question. Has your journey been documented in terms of film, what you've been doing? Has anyone wanted to put this on film so you have this, you know, to show other people when you come back to the States?
Right. Yeah. So I've got my, you know, and until I get the final letters, I can't tell you where they are. But our first, you know, peer-reviewed professional publication articles are out, which is important. So we're starting to publish in the community and get these ideas out there to be properly vetted. I'll continue to do that because I think it's key to get it in the publication world. And now I've moved forward to speaking, you know, in public forums about this. Now, one of the, you know, I'm caught between a rock and a hard place because I need to get the message out. I need to be an ambassador about this. But, you know, for me to say we are going to go into country X and spend the next 6 months using these weapons to go after an organized criminal network is a stupid thing to do. So, you know, I'm torn between I have to share enough to get, you know, the recognition, the enthusiasm, the funding, the motivation, and yet not share so much that we endanger, you know, our field personnel, the victims, or the overall success of the operation. So it's kind of a tricky balance we're doing.
Family? Are you, they must be concerned about you going into these places as well. But come back and give us an update at some point when you feel like you can? We could devote an hour to it if you want to be an ambassador. We would love to do that because we've only scratched the surface, and I know that we can impart some of our people that may want to do whatever they can for human trafficking too. So, Tim, thank you so much for being such a vital part of this show. It's very special to me, and I'm indebted. And so let's keep in touch, and thank you so much again.
Congratulations. Great deal.
Thank you. We're very pleased. So you have a good rest of the evening. Delilah, thank you so much for everything that you've done in 2 years. Phone hug. And can you hear me?
Yes, I'm
phone
right
hug.
Here.
Okay. You know, I don't know what to say except, you know, thank you from the bottom of my heart. You're special to me.
Well,
and
you
just
did
for
it.
The record. Huh?
I said you did it for 2 years. Congratulations, and many see more to come. And I think, you know, if we can put on this quality of a show with this quality of guests we've had in the past 2 years, there's nowhere to go but up.
Well, I hope so, and I just want our listenership to keep that in mind. And I know other responsibilities take them away, but please do come back to us because they're always on the archives as well, and we need you as an audience in order for the education to get out there. So without further ado, I'm going to say good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for participating in the anniversary show. It's very special to me, and we will see you this coming Saturday for another edition. So good evening. Thank you, Will. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Delilah, and God bless everyone.
Good night, everyone. Good night, Tim.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night, Tim.